This is part one of the István Deák interview recorded on December 5th, 2009.
So we're here with István Deák in his apartment at 410 Riverside Drive, and it's December 5th, 2009, and we're talking to him about his life and experiences during the 20th century. I'd just like to open by asking you to tell us a bit about your family and about your childhood, and narrate as thickly as possible the long history that overlaps you before you're born and into your life.
Quite obviously, I don't know too much about the older history of my family, because only high noblemen with family archives are able to look back into pre-19th century history. There were no official registries. As you probably know, birth, marriage, and death were not recorded until late 18th century, except by the church or by families in the family prayer book and things like this. Now, all this doesn't apply to us, because my ancestors on both sides were Jewish. We have no idea where they came from, although certain signs point in the direction of Moravia. It is quite common, well before the big massive immigration from Galicia, or Jewish immigration from Galicia, Jews drifted from the western part of the Habsburg Empire, especially from Moravia, into Hungary and Transylvania. Either they had been expelled by Maria Theresa, or there were simply better opportunities to move. So what we know is that my ancestors suddenly appear in late 18th century. They appear in western Hungary, in Burgenland, in Rohonc, and Székesfehérvár. Székesfehérvár is already a great step forward, because it was a free royal city to which not only Jews but other foreign nationals were not admitted until mid-19th century, but exceptions were made, and my paternal ancestors were such an exception, which meant that they were already rather assimilated and also fairly well off. Now, they have a picture from the 1850s, which shows my paternal great-grandfather, who was born around 1803, I think. And he sits there with his numerous family, with his 12 children, in Hungarian, sort of a Hungarian national costume. I also know that this paternal great-grandfather, who was named Emmanuel, he served in some capacity in the Hungarian National Guard. One would have to investigate it, but I don't know how, when and where and how I would find evidence. It is quite interesting because, as you might know, in 1848, the National Guard, which became Honvéd, was set up, to which people were admitted who previously had not been able to serve in any capacity, were not asked to serve. And this applied to Jews, who then applied in very large numbers. But already in 1848, there was an immediate anti-Semitic reaction to it, especially in the large cities like Pozsony, Bratislava, or Székesfehérvár, or Budapest. And the Batthyány government, which was the first legal but still already somewhat revolutionary government, responded to the pogroms by expelling the Jews from the National Guard. Whether this meant that my great-grandfather was in the National Guard and out of it again, or the law and the resolutions were not applied consistently, is unclear to me. Definitely, his name exists in one of the documents listing members of the National Guard in Székesfehérvár. The other side of my family, my maternal side, is totally unknown to me. I've never heard of anybody mentioned, or clearly was less illustrious Then the paternal said, otherwise there would be some documentation. One of my paternal ancestors, I think he's the father of my great-grandfather, but I'm not quite sure, was a theologian, a Jewish theologian, and he is in every Hungarian encyclopedia. Rivai Nagy Lexikon, for instance, is a considerable. Of course, he's not the father of my great-grandfather. He is the father of my grandmother's, of my grandmother, on the paternal side. And he was, he figures by the name of Tzipse. His name was Tzipse. He figures in the Rivai Nagy Lexikon. And even I have a book of his which he wrote in German. The change from German speaking tradition to Hungarian, the assimilation process can be followed with, not with exactitude, but with special interest, for me at least, because it's my family, through some of the family traditions and documentation. For instance, this Tzipse, who was a chief rabbi of Székesfehérvár, he was a reform rabbi, that is, he's on my great-grandfather on my paternal side, but through my grandmother on the paternal side, he was a reform rabbi, a reform theologian, which meant that he already conducted services in Hungarian. He preached in Hungarian, for which he was very badly, very strongly attacked. This I have from family documentation. Attacked by the Orthodox part of the community, finally had to leave Székesfehérvár and move to back to Rohonc, where the family apparently is coming from, what is today in Burgenland, Austria, and became rabbi there. There is an eternal struggle in every church, but in the Jewish religion community especially, an eternal trouble between the masculine, that is the reformers, the ones who want to change and assimilate and be part of a modern society, and others who are afraid of these changes and are opposed to it, for perfectly understandable reasons, because the logical end of this assimilation is exactly what happened to my family: change of name and finally change of religion and total repudiation of the past, even including silence about the past. So this is more or less what I know about my ancestry. It's one of the older families which helped us, for instance, at the time of the first anti-Jewish laws of 1938, which still respected those or exempted those whose ancestors were in Hungary before a certain date and whose ancestors were already doing something for the country. In fact, all through the whole period, even up to 1944, and as I mentioned this in my talk in Budapest recently, there was an enormous difference between the privileged and the underprivileged of the generally persecuted Jewish minority, because the privileged, whether you were privileged by money or privileged by education, privileged by Gentile connections, or privileged by all three, which is what usually happened, were in a very advantageous situation. When it came to survival, the chances of our family's survival, I would say, were infinitely better, 100 times better than the opposite, non-assimilated, Orthodox, or Hasidic, non-Hungarian-speaking, poor Jews who were at least half, if not more, of the Hungarian Jewish community. Now, beginning to talk about my grandfather, on the paternal side, again, I had no idea about the maternal side, except that they were also from Székesfehérvár, and both had the same name, but they were probably not related. Both were called Deutsch. Now, Deutsch, why were they called Deutsch? Because probably they came from the West and spoke fluent German. And when Joseph II ordered the everybody in the monarchy, not only Jews, to have a family name, and those names were handed out by the local authorities, mostly local Habsburg authorities, and the local level, very often local military authorities, including army sergeants who were in charge of handing out names. They went by the looks of the person, they went by the something that they heard about the person, or if the person was in a position, by the money that the person paid. So if the person asked to be called Gold, which is not so bad because you are golden then and it seems that you have money, that's what got. If the person was unable to pay or the authorities in charge did not like the person, gave him a bad name. So I guess we have absolutely no evidence of this, that in both cases these people spoke, definitely they didn't know any Yiddish, nobody in the family ever heard of Yiddish. But originally they spoke High German, which they brought themselves from the West, and then changed to Hungarian. And this is what seems to have happened to my grandfather, who was one of, as I mentioned, one of 12 children. Incidentally, several of his brothers, my paternal grandfather's brothers and sisters, moved to Germany, and some to America, but were there, they disappeared. But interestingly, one or two of my grandfather's brothers lived in Germany even in Nazi times, and for some reason nothing happened to them, and at least one of them appeared, at least wrote a letter after the war. Another one wrote a letter to us from New York. That's all what I know about them. My grandfather himself became a merchant, and he was the owner of the largest textile store in Segesfehérvár on the main square opposite the big church, whose name I don't know, I don't remember exactly. It was a whole building. He was one of the wealthiest members of the Segesfehérvár community. Apparently he was greatly respected. Apparently he was sort of seen as a patrician in Segesfehérvár. I myself remember that every morning when I was staying with him, my grandfather died only in 1940, so I was 14 when he died, and I remember the last few years of his life very well. He was a very dignified man. If you remember, if you look at his picture, you will see that he had a very beautiful white mustache. Every morning he got up, prepared to go to the shop, and there was always a two-horse carriage waiting for him. He got in, and then when I accompanied him to in the morning, we had to be very careful to greet people who passed by, who always greeted my grandfather by lifting their head, and my grandfather answered, and I had to answer, and I had to wear white gloves for that occasion. So it was all very formal and actually very nice. The store, as far as I remember, was quite large, maybe 20 employees altogether. And what was so interesting, that normal traffic was like in any city, but on weekends, especially on Sunday, was that on Sunday? On weekend, I don't remember, that was Sunday. Sunday the peasants came in from the countryside and actually stormed into the store trying to buy what they were saving money for, bargaining widely. There were more German peasants in the Segesfehérvár area than Hungarians, but it was an unforgettable scene for me. All these peasant women who came, very often they came with eggs or butter and things like this, which they wanted to exchange for some whatever what they needed. All of them seemed to want shawls and kerchiefs, but obviously they also were buying other things. It was all very traditional and in many ways highly attractive, and I have a certain nostalgia for that scene. It was also very common in this city, in Segesfehérvár, which was a rather small city of about 40,000 at that time, for us on Sunday morning to walk with grandfather and my father and my uncle, the one who remained, Pali Bhaji, who remained the Sekeshwara, to walk up and down the so-called Corso, again wearing white gloves, and greet passers-by. So it all looked extremely peaceful and happy, but of course it wasn't. It wasn't very peaceful for my grandfather either, because he was born in 1852, so he obviously did not draftable during World War I. I mean, to think that my grandfather was 62 years old when the war began is almost unbelievable. But that's what he was. My great-grandfather was born early in the 19th century, so my great-great-grandfather was born in the 18th century. My grandfather, in any case, was 62, but he had four sons, and all four sons were drafted into the army. My father had been to the Cistercian Gymnasium, which was not one of the very few, perhaps two or three gymnasiums in Székesfehérvár. I think the other one was the Franciscan, and there were also state gymnasium. But the best one was the Cistercian, and to show the tolerance of the Cistercian fathers and the tolerance, of course, of the period, that my father was admitted, even though he was not yet converted. And at least half of the class was Jewish, as it was very customary in many, many gymnasia. One of his classmates was Lanczos Kornél, who became a very famous physician and lived in physicist and mathematician and lived in America. And he's in this book by Tibor Frank, which is now appeared on Hungarian Jewish intellectuals in the West. Nobody ever discriminated against my family or against my father. They seem to have been admitted. I mean, nobody openly discriminated. Of course, we have no idea about people's private feelings. Certainly, my father never complained about any kind of discrimination during the war. In fact, the war was for him sort of the apogee of a very good life until that time, an enthusiastic period, a great period of his life. Even during World War II, in the first years of World War II, when he heard of people who skirted army service or deserted, he was outraged. Even though this is World War II, in which the Nazis are the Hungarian allies, my father first said, everybody has to do his service, he has to do his duty. Because that was World War I, what was, as I said, a great experience for him. He had just finished Polytechnical University, which is another achievement that he was admitted without any problem, and was one of the, how many, maybe they graduated a few hundred engineers before him. He was mechanical machine engineering, that was his specialty. He finished it, he was drafted into the army in 1914 and served enthusiastically. The army for him meant the 6 Austro-Hungarian so-called Common Army Fortress Artillery Regiment. Fortress artillery was actually the medium heavy artillery, mostly 15 centimeter howitzers. And within a few weeks, they were sent to the Russian front, and that's where he served for the Russian front for about 2 years, more than 2 years. He has a few anecdotes to tell about this period, but my father never talked about real problems, about the suffering, the death, the misery in which they must have lived. For him and for his army buddies, whom I knew, life experience was, or the task was, to tell anecdotes, mostly amusing anecdotes about World War I, about how, when he was already a young lieutenant, he was ordered to stand in line for the arrival of a high-ranking general, and the general came up. It's okay? Is the speed okay so far? Yeah. The general came and singled out my father because he didn't have a mustache. And everybody in my father's army corps was ordered to have a mustache. He didn't have a mustache because he didn't grow. And so the general yelled at him and he said, when I come back in 4 weeks, you must have a mustache. And my father then apparently painted a mustache for his face. That's one anecdote he told. Then there were some other anecdotes that he was on the front line and the army, the artillery was firing. It's a huge gun. You can see it. 15-centimeter howitzers in the Var in Buda, in front, pointing toward the hills, the mountains and the hills, and it's behind the Ministry of, or the Museum of Defense, I mean, War Museum. And this incredible racket, he was sleeping very well until they stopped firing, whereupon he immediately woke up. That's another anecdote. The third anecdote is that his batman, of course every officer had a batman, brought him something to drink, and then he said, "Batman, if this is coffee, then bring me tea. If it's tea, bring me coffee." And that was one, and there was other great stories. And then how he was eating his guyash or whatever, and then there was an explosion next to him, and the steel parts, shrapnel, went through his dish, and therefore he lost his guyash, and he was very upset about it. Never a serious story, never something dramatic. Then, oh yes, then he told, again, always sort of cynical but still rather proud way, he told me how they were then sent in 1916 to Montenegro to take this little state, which was an ally of Serbia and the other allies, and then how that was his only military victory, or that of his unit, when they stormed the Lovćen, which is a mountain in Montenegro, leading up to Cetinje, which was at that time the capital of Montenegro, and then how interesting it was, and that he saw the king, Nikita, who was captured, and then how miserable Nikita looked, so that he mentioned also. Then he was sent back to the Russian front and experienced the Battle of Lutsk, which is also called the Brusilov Offensive, which was the great breakthrough for the Russians, the only great victory in which they captured something like 300,000 Austro-Hungarian soldiers. And then he said, for the first and only time in history, his artillery battery, where every gun was pulled by 12 horses, began to gallop, and that he never been before. And what an incredible experience it was to gallop away from the enemy, not towards the enemy, but away from the enemy, because suddenly the rumor spread that the Cossacks, as he always says this in German, the Cossacks coming, the Cossacks coming, and then we all started to run. And that's how he was not captured. From there he was transferred to Vienna to some training, continued training, where he was for a few months, and he was there when Francis Joseph died. So another experience, which he never relates anything, just mentions that he was there and Spalierstein, to stand along the route of the cortege and for hours and hours and salute him. And that it was a shattering experience because his life was closely connected as that of everybody in the monarchy to that of the old emperor. From there he was sent to the Italian front where he served until the end of the war. Although at the very end of the war he was no longer in the front line because he had almost 4 years front line experience, which is a miracle that he survived. Of course, in the artillery, your survival chances were better than in the infantry, but even in the artillery, 4 years without being captured, without being heavily wounded, without being killed, was almost a miracle. So in the last few months of the war, he was sent somewhat back, and he was in charge of ammunition depot, huge depot, where incidentally several hundred, maybe thousand, that I don't remember, Italian POWs were working. And I asked him how were they treated, the Italians, and he said, I had nothing to do with it, that was the business of those who brought the Italian prisoners to the depot every day and took them away. And that made me think a lot afterwards, because after all, during World War II, every German and more or less every commander everywhere always had this explanation, it was not my job, it was not my business, I was not in charge of the provisions. I said, but what do they look like? Did you ever talk to them? Oh yes, I talked to them. They were okay. I think they were fed adequately. I think. And that was the only, again, and only time when I felt a little bit strange about my father's behavior. That, of course, I'm sure that at his age I would have been very similar, and without my experiences, but only with his experiences as a very enthusiastic warrior for the monarchy and for Hungary, he did not worry too much about the condition of the Italian prisoners. But we know that about one third of the prisoners in Austria-Hungary died. Same on the other side, of course. Hungarian prisoners, Austro-Hungarian prisoners in Italy also died. Huge numbers. Now, they died because of illnesses, but also towards the end of the war because of malnutrition. There was very little to eat, and the prisoners got the least of it. So it's all these nice stories about World War I, that's the only story regarding my father that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. And then in the end of the war, he said, when they heard the rumor, or actually only rumor, that Austria-Hungary was surrendering, and they were ordered back, then they decided to blow up the whole ammunition depot. And he said this was the greatest spectacle he has ever seen in his life. Thousands and thousands of tons of high explosives were exploded at the same time. It was a fireworks to defy all fireworks. And then they came home, and the story is interesting because it's typical, and here I have a confirmation of this typical story, that how the army fell apart. That were, after all, in his unit, there were, this is a common army unit, there were people of several nationalities. Already in the beginning of the war, he told me that in his battery, the gunners were Czechs, and the men who took care of the horses were Croats, and the officers were all Budapest engineers. And only the commander, whose picture is in the book, there's a book in which my father sits in a canteen during World War I, in my own book about the army, army officer corps, and there is my father and two other officers. And the one in the middle is the commander of the battery, who is the only carrier officer in the whole battery. The other officer is the deputy commander, who is already a Hungarian engineer, and so is my father, and he said all his other fellow officers in the battery were Hungarian engineers, and that's why they became quite good friends after the war, and he saw some of his battery comrades in 1970 still, 50, 60 years after the war, they were still meeting quite regularly. Not only because they had the common experience of the war, at least for the first few years, until my father was sent somewhere else, but also because they really came from the same world and had the same profession. So then they go home, and then he said this was really quite exciting, that they reached the border of coming back from Italy, from northern Italy, at one point around Trieste, I think, I don't remember what he said. Suddenly, the train on which they were all traveling on top of each other, the train is stopped, there are Austro-Hungarian officers down with wearing armbands of the Serbian kingdom, and they now represent ODIHR. I think it must have been Serbian. In any case, those officers said, we are now representing the Triun kingdom of Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia, and we are now going to give you papers to go home. We are going to go through a triage, and those who can show that they live outside of our territory, outside of South Slav kingdoms, will be given the necessary papers for an orderly withdrawal. And since he could show that he was from Székesfehérvár, he said he was given by them, and he had it sometimes. I showed it to me, but I don't know where it is. It is in German and in, I guess, Serbo-Croatian, I don't remember that, sort of an ID card which says that István Deák, Oberleutnant de Artillerie, István Deák, so it's still in German there, and still in the name of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, but fellow officers who now represent another state give him, authorize him to go home. And so that's how he got to Székesfehérvár, and there he had no choice but to stay in the army, because at least in the army he was fed. And at that time they had no other income. He had no income whatsoever. In fact, he said, I have no profession. I finished the university, Polytechnical University, but doesn't mean that I had knew anything. He repeated it, I knew nothing. It was totally useless what I learned in Polytechnical University for my actual work as an engineer. But he stayed in the army, therefore he became a Red Army soldier when the communists took over. And then afterwards he still stayed in the army, so he became a White Army soldier. So he has this, and he said this was very common, that all of us were through this period, and we were simply still officers, had absolutely nothing to do. Of course, there was no more artillery, there was nothing, but he went there mostly to pick up his ridiculous wages, which were worth almost nothing, because you could buy nothing with them, with the money at that time, but at least there was twice a day there was a meal. Then came the real serious problem, that in 1920, when it was all over and he was finally officially demobilized and became Lieutenant de Reserve, then he had to look for a profession and for a livelihood. Of course, it was a huge help that his father was well-to-do. And so were his brothers. One of his brothers, Imre, was a very handsome man, he became a lawyer. The oldest one stayed in Székesfehérvár and eventually inherited the shop, but he was working in the shop the whole time. And the youngest brother became a very, very well-to-do Budapest merchant. Not only had a shop in Kígyó utca, which is one of the best streets in Budapest, called Ádám Kft., but he also had a factory, and he was really extremely wealthy. The youngest brother, who married into a Hungarian industrialist family of Czech origin, who created and partly owned the largest Hungarian chemical plant, Hungaria. So my father is helped by his own father and by his friends, by his family members, to set up a new household. That's when he marries my mother. That's when they move. In 1920 they marry, and in 1922, how is that possible? Now, of course, they don't move. What am I talking nonsense? I'm sorry. 1922, my sister is born. They are still in Székesfehérvár. My father, by this time, is already partner in an artesian well drilling company, which consists of two engineers and a few employees, and which functioned quite well in the 1920s until the Great Depression. But before we come to that, let me mention again, so my sister Eva was born in Székesfehérvár in 1922. I was born in Székesfehérvár in 1926, May 11, 1926. And 3 weeks later, the whole family moves to Budapest. And moves to Naphegy, which is in Buda, which is a nice place, which overlooks... We could see the Danube from our building. I remember the apartment a little bit because I was 6 when we moved out of there. And I remember life on Naphegy, which was very nice because there were few houses, so we could play on the top of the hill, and it was the world was ours. So I believe, and my sister confirms this, that my parents were acceptably well-to-do. Of course, they couldn't dream of any luxuries, like my uncle Károly, who was very, very wealthy, and who owned the Lancia car, the first Lancia Italian sports car in Hungary, and who also traveled abroad, who in 1936 went to the Berlin Olympics with his wife, who went on cruises to the north, to northern Norway, who went to Paris every year practically. Now that's a lifestyle that my own family couldn't even dream of, because what happened was that he lost everything in the Great Depression, and the firm collapsed, and his partner absconded, apparently, not with money, but without having trying to pay the debt they had, absconded to America, as it always happens in family lore. There is always a family member or a partner who absconds to America, leaves the others in a distressing situation. So what I found about them after my father's death, my father died in 1980, what I found about them was, about this whole story, was a document left in my father's legacy, in which my grandfather and his 3 sons pledge $500,000 pengus in 1930, which is like $50 million today, I would say. Offhand, I would say, it's an enormous amount of money. To rescue my father, to pay his debts, and to set him up somehow, in which he pledges to pay back these monies which the 3 brothers each contribute, plus my grandfather, all together, this incredible sum, $500,000 pengus or more, I don't remember exactly, in installments without interest. So it was almost like a gift. And then after my father died, and the youngest brother, the Budapest, the wealthy one, was alive in Buda, and I asked him once, did my father ever pay back anything? And he said, of course he couldn't, he didn't, we never expected it, but it was legally necessary to draw up this document. So I know that my father, my family was rescued by my enlarged family. It was a good family. So that was, my father was then, had a new job, and the new job was to be chief engineer of the first Budapest bus company, BART, Budapesti Autobus Részvény Társaság, BART. He was sort of specifically in charge of the buses that went from the city to Margitsziget, which as a consequence meant that we had free entry to Palatinusbath. And as children of the Palatinus Strand, we always went there, free entry. So he was, again, rather privileged. He, being in charge of the autobus company, which at first had only a few dozen buses, he was in charge of hiring people. And he told me that during the Great Depression, they only hired fellow engineers. That all the chauffeurs and all the conductors were diplôme ingénieurs. There was such a terrible unemployment in Hungary that at least he took care of some of his fellow engineers. university degrees, driving a bus. This ended somewhere in the mid-1930s, and then my father, and I really have no explanation for this, my father became the Secretary General of the Ipar Művészeti Társulat, the Association for Industrial Arts. And that's what he did in the next few years. Plus, he also rented the largest garage in Budapest, the so-called Cyclops garage, in Nagyatádi utca, Kerti, previously Kertész utca. And with that came a little automobile parts establishment where they, I don't know what they did, I guess they just made some automobile parts which were not available. So he had something to do with automobiles. It was rather demeaning for an engineer to be not really working the profession, but then with the anti-Semitic laws, he was very glad and happy, I'm sure, or lucky not to have lost his job, but to have firm income as the manager of this large garage, and also as Secretary General of the Association for Industrial Arts. About each of these jobs and professions, just a few tiny little anecdotes. About the garage, all I remember that one day, I remember many things, but the only thing worth relating is that one day, just when I was visiting, an unbelievable noise approached us in the street, and it turned out that about 100 Italian balilla, young fascist children, 13 or 14, arrived and parked their motorcycles in my father's garage. My father, of course, knew that they would be coming, but it was a huge excitement. There were 100 motorcycles, and all kids, and on their own practically, they had some leaders with them. But still, the idea that they came all the way from Italy to Budapest, and that 13-year-old kids can do that, and they can sit on a motorcycle, was overwhelming for me, of course, because we couldn't. I had a bicycle, but I couldn't have dreamed of a motorcycle. So if you are interested, why is fascism in its many varieties attractive to young people? This is why it is attractive. Because it gave opportunity to at least a certain number of kids to do things that normally kids can only dream of. And the others who could not sit on, were not allowed to sit on a bicycle, motorcycle, were not sent to Hungary on a big tour, at least they had a vague hope that one day they would do the same. Whereas in Hungary, you were really stuck in a very poor way of life, and there was nothing dashing and nothing exciting about it. I remember the first Hitlerjugend marching into Budapest, and that's almost the same thing. For me, they were marching and not riding a motorcycle. But what they had, and what for that time was just overwhelmingly attractive to me and enviable, is that they had short shorts on. That was we would have liked to have short shorts, but we were not allowed to have short shorts. So when I was a Boy Scout or when I was in high school, my shorts had to go down to the knee. Today every kid wears shorts that are below the knee, which I find unbelievably ugly and unattractive. But for us, the hope was to be allowed to have short shorts, short, that short. And that's what the Balilla had, and that's what the Hitlerjugend had. And that also gave us kids the impression that these are some highly spoiled and incredibly enviable people who come from countries which are much ahead of our country. And that I would like to emphasize that for East Europeans in general, I'm quite sure of that, certainly for us Hungarians, Hungarian kids, no matter what bad things we heard about Nazi Germany, the not less bad things about Italy was always, Italy was always treated as a fascism, as not to be taken that seriously, and it's overwhelmingly still Italy and a good place. But for Nazism, one heard horrible things from the very beginning, but still it's a country in which in many ways is far ahead of ours, and also much more democratic That definitely was a feeling that we had, more egalitarian. And for that I have made many, many proofs. As seen by a kid, by a child like myself, for instance, that the Hitlerjugend and the Balila included children from all wakes of life in which they were together, and their leaders were from among them, unlike our Boy Scout leaders, who were unattractive, older men and priests. There, the Hitlerjugend leaders were young themselves, much younger than the Boy Scout leaders in Hungary, and definitely had this atmosphere, this gave the feeling that this is an egalitarian, more egalitarian society. Another truth which we repeated to each other endlessly, when 1941, when the German troops crossed Hungary in order to attack Yugoslavia, and we watched them on the Danube shore, endless columns of German motorized infantry, trucks and motorcycles, with sidecars. Very often we saw that there's a soldier and officer on a motorcycle. One is a sidecar and the other sits on the motorcycle. And it's not the officer who sits in the sidecar, but the ordinary soldier, and the officer is driving. Or in a car we saw soldiers and officers, and it was not the officer who sat next to the chauffeur or behind him, but he was driving. Now how often this happened I have no idea. After all, we know that even the German Nazi army until the last few years were still quite hierarchical and rather traditional. But compared to the feudal Hungarian army, which is all its Austro-Hungarian tradition, this was the spectacle of superhuman beings who live in a kind of society that in many ways is enviable, in which young people are full of themselves, very conceited. We didn't like the Hitlerjugend because we thought of them as very arrogant. But at the same time, we definitely envied them for their way of life. So that's going back to my father then. He is... In 1939, he comes to America. He's sent by his association to participate in the closing of the Hungarian Pavilion at the World's Fair. I have a book which was published at that time about the Hungarian Pavilion at the famous New York World's Fair of 1939. He came here on an Italian passenger ship, the Rex, which is very famous, sort of a dream-like beauty of a ship, huge. And he went back in 1940 during the war, already the same Rex, the last time the Rex was able to cross from New York to Genoa. And then Italy entered the war itself. And when he came back, Italy was still a neutral country. So he was here for about 5 months, and there's always this family speculation, what if he hadn't been able to come back? And if we had survived, we would have become Americans by that time. But generally, I think if my father had decided not to come back, we would have been in incredible trouble and also very sad. After all, we were a good family. We really loved each other very much. Very, very. I wouldn't say we were close, because in those old-fashioned world, people were not close. In that, we never exchanged intimate thoughts. This is not aside, but never mind. One can always tell things chronologically. I think it would be quite worth considering and what changes one undergoes in one's life. In lifestyle, in today, when parents and children either don't communicate at all or communicate on a level which I find almost intolerably too intimate, everything is exchanged, everything knows, they smoke pot together and they sleep, women all together and all sorts of things which I would have been unheard of, inconceivable. I've never heard one sentence from my parents about sex life, about their relationship, whether they loved each other or not. Nothing. They gave every sign of loving us, but certainly my father never would have said, I love you, my children. My father was an authority, and he was very warm compared to how other families behaved. Jewish families or families of Jewish origin were generally much warmer and more bourgeois, more middle class than gentry families, where children were very often brought up without their parents, but brought up in schools or were brought up in vet nurses and afterwards, outside the immediate household. But we were brought up together. We were at home, we were in a small apartment. But still, I never heard anything about their life. I don't know anything about their life. You can't ask me whether the mother was happy or unhappy, whether she was a very beautiful woman, whether she had lovers or not, what she actually was doing. What was she doing? She never had a profession. She didn't finish high school because that was not done. She went to a Bürgerschule. That she finished, I think, I'm not sure. She was very well read. She spoke fluent German.